This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org. Stay tuned for a Farm and Garden Show with J. Allison Moscariello and Bill Taylor. Today we discuss sheep farming and using horsepower on the farm with Don Hughes and Mary Rose Livingston of Northland Sheep Farm in Marathon, New York.
This is our planet, the one that we all share. Let us remember that all life breathes the air. Our world is sacred, its future in our trust.
And first, some upcoming events. The Great Barrington Seed Library needs a coordinator to provide this community resource. Contact the Great Barrington Public Library at 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Once again, 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Here are the farmers markets in Berkshire County and adjacent New York State. Copaic Hillsdale Farmers Market is at 9140 Route 22 in Copaic, New York, Saturdays through November 23rd, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Great Barrington Farmers Market is at 18 Church Street, Great Barrington, Saturdays through November 9th, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Lee Farmers Market is at 25 Park Place in front of the First Congregational Church in Lee, Saturdays through October 12th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Millerton Farmers Market is at Millerton Methodist Church, 6 Duchess Avenue in Millerton, New York, Saturdays 10 to 2 year-round. North Adams Farmers Market meets on Main Street from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. every Saturday through October 19th, and they happily take cash, cards, and SNAP/EBT with a market match of up to $30 for SNAP/EBT, and most of the farmers markets in Massachusetts take similar. Otis Farmers Market is 2000 East Otis Road in the parking lot of Papa's Healthy Food and Fuel in East Otis, Saturdays through October 12th, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Pittsfield Farmers Market is at the Common, 101st Street in Pittsfield, Saturdays through October 12th, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., sponsored by Roots Rising. Sheffield Farmers Market is at the First Congregational Church, 125 Main Street, Fridays 3 to 6 p.m. through October 11th. West Stockbridge Farmers Market is at the Foundry Green on Harris Street in West Stockbridge, Thursdays through October 3rd, 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Other markets in North County and information on all markets can be found at berkshiregrown.org. And here's one more market. Williamstown Farmers Market is at Spring Street Municipal Parking Lot every Saturday from 9 to 1 through November 2nd. Berkshire Botanical Garden in Stockbridge offers many classes on gardening, horticulture, cooking, and other garden-related topics. The website berkshirebotanical.org/events has listings. Phone is 413-298-3926. That's 413-298-3926. Email is info@berkshirebotanical.org. Hancock Shaker Village has many events, including a 90-minute tour every Wednesday from 10 to 11:30 in the morning, blacksmithing, timber frame building, Shaker Supper September 12th, November 1st and 30th, and much more. Email is info@hancockshakervillage.org. Website is hancockshakervillage.org. Berkshire Agricultural Ventures will hold a community event September 18th, ahead of Climate Week New York, to raise awareness of the climate-related challenges facing farmers in the region. Through the perspectives of local farmers and regional experts, hear about pressing issues on our local farms as well as solutions being implemented in partnership with BAV and others. All community members interested in climate issues and the viability of local agriculture are invited to attend. The event will run September 18th from 5 to 7 p.m., and an optional Greenagers Farm Tour begins at 4 p.m. Location is 62 Under Mountain Road, South Egremont. On September 19th and October 17th, from 5:30 to 6:30, Ariana Collins, director of the Hoosick River Watershed Association, and Justin Adkins, co-owner of Wild Soul River, explore the Hoosick River Valley, talking about the plants growing along the river and their many connections to the lives around them, including humans. Quote, "We will each enter this space as teacher and learning together," unquote, they say. Quote, "as we learn from the plants of the ancestral homelands of the Stockbridge Munsee Mohicans." Registration is at wildsoulriver.com. On September 24th, a similar walk meets at the Clark Museum from 4 to 5 p.m. Registration required through the Clark Art Institute, 413-458-2303 to register. Once again, 413-458-2303 to register, and that is in Williamstown. Don Hughes and Mary Rose Livingston run Northland Sheep Farm in Marathon, New York, in the Finger Lakes region. Don is an accomplished teamster and has trained many others how to work with draft animals on a farm. Mary Rose takes care of the sheep, is a former president of NOFA New York, and recently retired from the sheep dairy. Both have contributed greatly to the Finger Lakes region becoming an epicenter of local farms and local food.
Welcome, welcome, and thank you for coming to our show. Let me start out with this question. Don, how did you get involved with working with horses, mules, and other draft animals? It's pretty fascinating, by the way.
Thank you. So it's been about 30 years ago. We both lived in Washington State, and I was walking down the street, and I saw some mules in my neighbor's yard. And I said, I don't know what that is, but I want one.
And,
at that time, I was a mountain climber, and yep. I thought I might use them in the mountains.
Uh-huh.
But I quickly discovered harnessing them and driving them and developed a real passion for being able to work with them.
That's great. What's your favorite part about working with the horses, mules, and all your other
That's a really great question because that's evolved. And
okay.
In the beginning, just the relationship that you can have with this animal, which is unlike other relationships with animals, because with a pet is a wonderful exchange of appreciation and love. With a herd or a flock, there's a connection, a really strong connection for the animals that milk for you or make meat, and you care for them. With a working draft animal, there's this constant communication. I need you to do this. I need you to do that. I want you to do this. I'm going to challenge you to do that. And it's really deep. And so that was in the beginning. That was the first thing that strikes you when you work with draft animals. Over time, I've come to realize that draft animals provide a really unique opportunity to work with other people. That's something that's unique about them as compared to machinery. Machinery tends to do the opposite. And that's my greatest joy is that draft animals, they don't guarantee that you will because our society and culture isn't really geared that way,
mm-hmm.
but they encourage you to work with people. And that's my greatest thing that I get from working with horses today is working with other people.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that. How is it that it encourages you to work with other people?
Well, their efficiency comes from human labor placed alongside them. So naturally, if you have more than one horse or more than two horses, then you get more than one person. And you can have all kinds of relationships like sharing, like community, like internships, like labor, like family. They all tend to work together and the horse kind of provides the opportunity to create that environment. It's really unusual. It's not something that most of us see or think about because most of our culture and systems today are bent the other way. We design a tractor so that you can be by yourself, almost encouraging you to be by yourself. And these animals encourage you to do the opposite.
And they take a command. Do they learn a certain set of words that you're giving them? Or is it you're indicating? How does that work? Because I was reading the article and it was fascinating, but I didn't quite understand how that communication works. I mean, listen, we all know we communicate with our animals. That's not a mystery. But how is it with working animals?
Oh, it's a good question. It's complex.
Uh-huh.
Because at the simplest level, there are some verbal commands and some signals I get with my hands, but then you develop a relationship. And so now these animals can anticipate and they can hear your voice. Like my horses will work for anybody, but they work better for me. And they'll do things for me that they won't do for other people. Because of our bond, because of their experience with me. And they say, you know, when Don called on us to move this heavy thing, it worked out okay. And they understand the tone of my voice. But that takes time. The very first day, you can kiss and make my horses move. But over time, you develop a relationship that's much deeper and much more nuanced. It's one of the exciting and fun parts about it.
So it's verbal. But it's also you communicate through the lines.
Yeah, at the simple level, it's verbal commands and using your hands to guide them with a bit. I mean, at the simple level, it's quite simple. And like playing a musical instrument, you learn the chords, but then you just keep learning. Like I continue to learn and will continue to learn throughout my life how to communicate better with working animals.
That's so wonderful. I said to Bill after reading the article, I said, can we get some horses? we don't have the land for it, but just the idea of being able to have this partner in life that is going to do things that are a little bit taxing for me right now, carrying all the wood and all the things like that.
Right.
I just love that. You know, Bill, did you want to ask me? You had that question. Let's ask Mary Rose.
Mary Rose, how did you become a sheep farmer and cheesemaker? I know you stopped doing the cheesemaking recently, but we can hear about that.
Yeah. Well, I primarily think of myself as a dairy farmer, really. When I was 9 years old, I went to Ireland for the first time. It's where my mom was from. And I saw a guy milk a cow. And I just thought that was it for me. I was sold right then. I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit. It's not like it was a normal thing for me to gravitate toward. But I was just really drawn to dairy farming. So through lots of different things, I majored in dairy science at Michigan State University, and I was a herdsman on cow dairy farms. So I always planned to milk cows. But when we moved to New York, we met the folks that founded the farm that we now live on, Jane and Carl North. They founded Northland Sheep Dairy. And we just lived in the same region and met through just having moved nearby. And they said that they were looking to retire and wanted to find a couple who would go into partnership with them and then buy them out. We said, well, we bought this other farm to milk cows on, but we ended up not really liking the farm that we bought. So we ended up selling that farm and throwing our lot in with Jane and Carl. And that's how we became sheep farm owners. And I had been making some cheese just on my own in my kitchen with my cow's milk. And then I started working with sheep milk, which is far superior. I loved milking cows, but once I met sheep, I never looked back. I just love being a shepherd, and I love the relationship with the flock. I loved milking. I still miss milking. I don't miss the cheese making, but I just love the sheep.
Tell me a little bit about loving the sheep and why. Compare the relationship between the cows and the sheep.
I mean, dairy cows, of course, have been so manipulated in terms of their genetics that I think they've lost a lot of their inherent genetic personalities, whereas sheep still have that flock mentality very much intact. They're very calming animals. I spend my day with two New Zealand Huntaway dogs that are just my constant companions, and it's me and the dogs and the sheep. And I love managing groups of animals. That's very appealing to me, whereas Don has this relationship with individual animals, with his work animals. Each one has a very different personality, has a different relationship, a different communication strategy with each of them. I like the communication involved in a herd or a flock dynamic. It just appeals to me more
like
than
a classroom.
That
it's a little bit like your own classroom.
That dynamic is just very appealing to me.
How is making cheese with sheep milk different than with cow milk? You said you like it a lot better. You liked it a lot better back when you were doing that. But for any aspiring cheese farmers out there, I know not everybody wants to do that, but some people listening might be interested in
it. Isn't it kinder to the human system?
Well, just some people can digest the proteins in small ruminant milk better than they can in the large ruminant milk. Mm-hmm. I just find with the sheep milk, and granted, I was managing my animals very differently than 99% of sheep dairy people. And that is, my animals are certified organic and also certified 100% grass-fed. So I was producing that kind of small ruminant milk. The flavor profile, just even in the fluid milk, it's a super clean flavor. It's not overly sugary. Like I find some cow's milk to be very sugary. And I actually don't like that taste. I like the very clean flavor. It's a naturally homogenized milk in the fluid milk form, so you don't have a cream line. And then when you're making cheese with it, not only do those clean, beautiful flavors translate into the cheese, you also get a higher yield of cheese.
Oh.
So, you know, when I'd be working in the vat making sheep milk cheese, I always felt like I was getting a lot of solids, curds. There was so much. And Every once in a while, I teach a class with cow's milk, and I think, where's all the solids? What, there's nothing in here. So it's just a beautiful, beautiful milk, and it makes fabulous cheese.
And makes me want some right now.
People around the world already know that. It's just in this country that sheep milk cheese is not as common and not as heard of. People just don't even, you say sheep, they say goat. But around the world, people realize that sheep's milk cheese is a super special thing.
And one more question, Mary Rose, is tell us about your time as president of NOFA New York.
Yeah, that was just my relationship with NOFA, which continues, has been so enriching to me. We were introduced to NOFA through other farmer friends. We came to New York, we were new here, we had no connections, and we started to meet other farmers. And then they introduced us to NOFA. It was just a way to really build community. And that was so important to us, having left a really rich community in Washington State. And that really helped us find community, other like-minded farmers, and that continues that relationship. And I was just on the board of NOFA during really great times, I have to say. I met so many amazing people, the executive directors I've been able to work with, who I still have very fond relationships with. And then just it really kind of fell in my lap being the president. I was the president for 5 years, and I thought that was such a gift to have that trust placed on me. But I was also there during pretty easy times. So there's
That's
been a
good.
lot of challenges for the organization, and I don't envy the current board president having to deal with that. It's just always been a really wonderful community of farmers and of staff and volunteer board members that I was just really, really glad to be part of. It was really wonderful.
Well, thank you for that. I have a question. I have two questions actually for both of you. One is, what was that like for you? What triggered the move to the East Coast? Because we did a similar transition a few years ago. What was the inspiration behind that? And then while we're talking about inspiration, talk to us about painting a picture of what your farm looks like. It's in the Finger Lakes area, and just how our listeners can imagine what your farm is looking like.
Sure. That was a difficult transition. Mary Rose and I met in Washington State, and at the time we met, I was already discovering that the things that I wanted to do, that I think we wanted to do, we probably weren't going to be able to do there. And some people don't realize that land values are so high there. Access to usable, especially for things like extensive grazing. It'd be one thing if you wanted a few acres to grow something, but extensive grazing and haymaking, which is what we wanted to do, was really impractical there. We just couldn't afford it. And it was heartbreaking for Mary Rose. She loved it there. I loved it there too, but
I still love it there.
I was a little more mentally prepared to move. So basically, I dragged us across the country as newlyweds. And this part of Central New York, again, people don't realize this part of Central New York was affordable. It was becoming abandoned farmland because where we live is in small hill country. Imagine rolling hills with very small farms, 30, 40, 50 acre farms, half of them in woods, all in little valleys with the sloping hillsides, which are really ideal for grass. They're ideal for haymaking, and they're really not ideal for much else. They're not ideal for commodity crops. They're not ideal for extensive plowing and planting. But the weather has been very conducive here for us. And even when people get dry spells in the east, we managed to knock off a few rainstorms and keep right on chugging.
We can grow a lot of grass here.
So it's been very fortunate for us to be here, and we love it here. It's very different than Washington. Like I said, I was a mountain climber when I was younger. Well, I just chose to give that up, and I'm okay with that. You don't keep everything that you start throughout your entire lifetime. You give one thing up to try another thing. So New York and Central New York has been great for us. And we live in a beautiful place. There isn't a single person that doesn't visit our farm that doesn't tell us how beautiful it is. And we always just say, yeah, we feel really lucky to live in such a beautiful place because we really do.
Yeah, I mean, New York was such a weird choice for us because we literally knew no one here. We had no connection. And, our first friend was a realtor who we bought a farm. So, but then finally meeting other farmers and organic farmers and like-minded farmers, now we have a super, super rich community here. But I cried every day for the first year of living in New York. I was bereft. of leaving Olympia, Washington, and I still go back every year. But painting a picture of the farm, so we're on kind of a hilltop, we're at about 1,400 feet. We only own about 57 acres, but we lease
Almost 100.
about 100 acres adjacent to us from our neighbors. We do have some woods here, but mostly we're growing grass. And one of the things we've enjoyed doing here that we wish we had done right when we arrived at this farm is that it took us a few years to figure out how valuable this is, and that's planting hedgerows. We do have some existing hedgerows that we inherited here, but now we're planting hedgerows in our fields, and that certainly helps with the livestock for shade during the summer, but it also helps in nutrient cycling and wind management, and it just looks really beautiful to see these beautiful hedgerows.
Are you doing any nut crops like hazelnuts in those hedgerows?
Not real. I mean, we do have some hazelnuts and filberts, or filberts in some of the hedgerows. But yeah, even though we're very close to some really great nut growers, Z's Nutty Ridge is just a couple of miles away from us, and they have a really great reputation. We haven't really gone there. We have a lot of black locust, which I probably shouldn't advertise because some people say you're not supposed to plant it, but they do very well here, and they're already on the farm anyway. And so we try and do diverse hedgerows. I like putting some conifers in there. Those help, especially in the early and late seasons when you have extreme weather. At least you still have some cover if the deciduous trees are not leafed at that time. So we try and do a diverse stand in our hedgerows.
I love black locust personally because it provides a partial shade, a nurse for other trees. The flowers are delicious. Not everybody knows that. Some books don't say they are, but they're really good. They taste like
And
candy
fragrant. Yeah.
and
Yeah.
fragrant.
Fragrant. Yeah.
And the
Beautiful.
wood is amazing for posts or anything like that. So it's a useful plant.
That is one piece of advice we would give to anybody starting out. We have some nice things that we've started in the last few years, but we have a hedgerow in front of our house that we planted about 15 years ago, and it is so useful already for shade and everything else. And so one piece of advice would be if you buy anything over 5 acres, plant some trees. And
Immediately.
part of the thing about the species of trees is we're obviously active grazers. This farm has got working animals on it all the time. Horses graze, sheep graze. We have a cow. It's hard to plant a tree and have it live. You have to chase after it. You have to plant it and take care of it, water it, fence it out, keep the animal away from it. Don't let them eat it. And we've killed a lot of trees, but it's still worth it. It's absolutely worth it. You have to figure out how to do it. You have to figure out where to put them. You have to figure out how to protect them, but it's absolutely worth it. We just want to do more and more.
The other thing that is unusual on our farm, and this is really Don's doing, is we have a farm community here. We have other farmers that live here with us and work with us and have their own enterprises. And Don has really fostered that relationship. I would just hang out all day with two dogs and my sheep and not talk to anybody. But Don loves working with other people. He loves collaboration. And because when we moved here, the folks who founded the farm had a home already that they'd built. When we arrived here, we also built a straw bale house here. So there's two houses on the property. Plus, Don also built another barn with an apartment in it. So there's actually three living spaces on the farm. And one of those spaces we used to use for seasonal interns, and we've had a person there for a couple of years now, more permanently. And of course, the other home has a younger farming couple that live there and use our draft horses and use the farm. And so there's a community of farmers that live right here with us,
That's which
great.
is, as we're getting older, that's one of the most exciting things happening today is that.
I think that's great. I mean, building community. That's one of the things, for some reason, I guess it wasn't meant to be. It didn't happen with our California place, so it was a little challenging, just the two of us, and
Then we had the fires, so we
then we had
needed
the
to leave.
fires, so that was a good impetus.
Right,
Time to
right. Can't
go.
even imagine. Right. Can't
Time to
imagine.
go. So I just want to hear more about.
The benefits of working with the draft animals and then difficulties was the question Jay was adding. We want both.
Well, the benefits are, aside from the personal or emotional benefits, it's a pretty significant ecological effect. The difference between a tractor and a draft horse ecologically is huge. Even though horses create some compaction, the way their feet move and the way their feet are spaced apart and the way their feet twist is a very different effect on the soil than a rolling rubber tire. And tractors are heavy. So tractor impact from compaction is a big difference. Fossil fuel use, to some people, that's the be all and end all. And maybe it's not, but it's a difference. The draft animals use less fossil fuels. And another really good example, I spend a lot of time working in the woods. We do some logging here. We collect our own firewood with horses, and I sell some logs. And lately, Julia Ramsey and I have developed a horse logging business. So looking at the woods environment just as a better way to see what's actually happening in your market garden, it's so obvious in the woods that the horses aren't trampling the soil. They're not wrecking the soil in order to extract the logs. Clean water is flowing through the woods at the same time you're extracting logs. And I have nothing against the person using machinery in the woods, except they're hard pressed by their economics to do a good job. They can do it and they do do it, but it's harder than it is with a pair of horses, where you don't have the same economic pressures to extract logs from the woods without wrecking the remaining trees. And then you can take the same ideas that you see in the woods, that are plainly obvious in the woods, and realize the same thing's happening in your market garden. You work at a slower pace, you have a little less soil impact, you just are a little bit closer to the land. And so when you're closer to it, you have a little bit more sensitivity to it. And that's the effect that horses have in the environment. The challenges are usually around how much you get done. And one of the questions I think is coming up is economics, but I've been thinking about it a lot, so I'm going to try and throw out my answer here. I've
Right.
answered this question. People ask, so what's the economic difference between working with a draft horse versus a tractor? I've been asked this question. We're all asked this question forever. I've been asked this question forever. And it's a tricky and difficult question to answer in some ways, but I'm going to take my best shot at it. And here it is. I think that there's at least a couple factors that affect your economics on a small farm more than your choice of power. So choosing to use draft horses is a choice of power source. I would say what you choose to sell, what you choose to grow in order to sell, and who you choose to sell it to, in other words, what markets you have access to, is one of the biggest factors in your economic viability of your small farm. I think that most people that go into small farming would have moral, ethical, or personal basis for what they choose to grow and what they choose to sell and who they choose to sell it to. So those are as important as the dollars involved. I think what you choose to do about labor, your own labor, hiring labor, having interns, working in community, working with families, those issues are huge to a small farm. I think they're going to be fundamental to the success or failure of the economics of a small farm. And that's true with a small tractor, with hand tools, or with horses. And I hope that people have moral, ethical, and personal reasons for how they choose their labor. Because labor is a very difficult thing to accomplish on a small farm. If you just straight up try to pay people, you run into two problems. One is they're not as invested if you haven't empowered them to feel like this is their farm. And then it's hard to pay them enough to want to work. And everybody complains about people not wanting to work. But why should they want to work if they're not invested in some other way? So draft horses are not the primary driver of the economics of this farm. They are a personal, ethical, and moral choice that I like to make and that I'm fortunate to make, but they're not ultimately what decides our success or failure economically. That said, draft horses do less than a tractor. That will always be true. Tractors are essentially industrialization. There's nothing wrong with that. I drive a car. How to get more out of the land or out of the system by incorporating machinery and fossil fuels. That's, to my definition, that's the definition of industrialization. And there's nothing wrong with that, just being realistic about that's what it is. We use a tractor today to do baling of hay, which we didn't used to do. We used to do with horses, but we got older and it got harder. And so we incorporated a tractor to do some of the work so that we could continue to use horses, so that we could continue to have sheep.
Don doesn't drive the tractor.
Yeah,
I drive the tractor.
I can't go that far.
He does have integrity.
But no, I mean, it's choices. Ultimately, it's choices. And that's what draft horses and the economics of draft animal power is. They can be very economically successful if all the other choices that somebody's made will allow them to. They fit very nicely in the small scale. They have great efficiencies in terms of initial cost, in terms of availability of equipment and tools. I'm probably getting into another future question, but
Okay. That's okay.
one of the questions was about the tools that we use. And one of the things that's interesting about the tools we use is that we mix tools from like three different eras. So there's lots of tools and equipment that come from horse-drawn eras of 100 years ago, which are completely serviceable, repairable, and usable. And those could be things like horse-drawn mowers, cultivators, rakes, tedders, manure spreaders. Then there was a whole bunch of equipment that was built for the early tractor era. The early tractor era tended to tow things because they were just mimicking what horses did. And so there's rakes, tedders, manure spreaders, all kinds of other genre of equipment that was made for a small tractor that works perfectly good with a horse. And then there's modern equipment with motors that Amish and non-Amish farmers are developing and incorporating into horse-powered operations, which just gives you this whole other range of flexible options for how to accomplish different tasks. And then there's a whole fourth genre, which I'm really excited about, which is horses lend themselves to innovation, which is kind of counterintuitive, but I love making stuff. And one of your questions was about no-till and low-till farming. And there is equipment being made to help support doing that with horses, but there's also some great innovative farmers that are creating stuff. One of my favorite things about Eric and Ann Nordell, who are pretty much famous draft horse farmers over the last 40 years in Pennsylvania, and writing in the Small Farmers Journal and sharing what they're doing and growing vegetables for a CSA and for a market. One of the things that I would take from them is the horses didn't limit how they did things. Horses opened up an opportunity for them to create their own systems. Everything you read about them is we invented a new way to grow an onion. We invented a new way to mulch something. We invented a new way to cover crop. We invented a new way to till or no-till or mulch.
And suppress weeds.
And we just used horses for power. And we didn't let that set us back in terms of options for how. And that's so exciting. And I've done that with haymaking. I make equipment. I use a PTO tractor apart and let the horses pull it, but the PTO shaft drives a spinning tedder. Not a big deal, but really fun and really satisfying conversion of equipment to my own purposes. Ken Lang in Ontario, Canada, has been working with customizing no-till drills specifically to horses, scaling them down, making them weight appropriate and draft appropriate, but developing systems around no-till drilling and incorporating some Amish rollers to crimp crops. So tons of things happening, no limit to the possibilities with draft animal power and equipment.
Can you repeat the names of those two farmers?
Sure. Eric and Ann Nordell are really well-known farmers from Pennsylvania. And Ken Lang is a farmer in Ontario, Canada.
Great. We're speaking with Don Hughes and Mary Rose Livingston of Northland Sheep Farm. Let's get contact information for you. How would people get in touch with you and learn more about what you're doing?
Sure. So the best way is probably our email, and people are welcome to contact us. We're totally happy with that. Our email is tripletree@frontiernet.net. And we have a couple websites. Our farm website is Northland Sheep
Dairy.
Farm.
You can say northlandsheepdairy.com.
Oh, yes. So they'll all end up going to the same place, northlandsheepdairy.com. And I have a website specifically to teaching Teamsters, which is teamsterschool.com.
Great. Again, your email is tripletree, tree in the forest, at frontiernet.net, right?
That's correct.
Yep, that's right.
Great.
And I wanted to ask you, because you are definitely a teacher, both of you, when did you start teaching and what geographical areas do you work?
Well, I've always loved teaching. I've taught all different kinds of things. I've taught youth and mountain climbing. I worked as a firefighter for a long time. Like, I just recently retired from the City of Cortland Fire Department.
Oh,
So
wow.
I did a lot of teaching in that role. And the thing I've had the most passion about teaching is working with draft animals. And here I've taught classes, I've taught interns. Today I'm putting together classes for people that come here to the farm and spend 2 or 3 or 4 days at a time learning these skills. So those are the different things that I've taught.
That sounds wonderful. Mary Rose, are you doing some teaching now also?
No. I have taught some cheese making classes, which I really dislike teaching. I just have to say, for some reason, I don't like teaching it, but I've been roped into doing it a few times. I used to work in adult education years ago, doing labor education, actually, and I enjoyed that. But No, I really just want to farm and be by myself with my dogs.
I'm with you. You and I are on the same place. Bill loves to teach. Give
And
me a nice quiet day.
so she tolerates me bringing lots of people through here and having them all over the place and driving her mad. And she makes dinners for people and she supports what I'm doing amazingly.
I understand
A
that.
grumpily,
I totally understand.
So we read about you in The Natural Farmer. There was a great cover article in the summer issue, I think it is. And I understand there'll be a whole issue in the winter dedicated to animal power. Are you working with other practitioners and were you instrumental in getting that issue to happen? Because it sounds like a great idea.
Well, yeah. Elizabeth, the editor, is a friend of ours, so.
Okay.
And she and I had talked for a long time about I like to showcase draft animal power whenever I can. But I think the idea of using an article by me to set up another issue was her idea, and I like it. There's a lot of young voices today that I'd love to see all being pulled together. People that I know, people that I don't know, people in different regions, people farming with different types of draft animals, people producing different kinds of crops. And I think that's a really neat, exciting thing. And I think that she's a great editor, so she'll figure out how to get something from all those people. And a lot of them I know, and I can help her contact people, but it's going to be fun to see what's in that issue.
Oh, yeah. And I have questions for you, Mary Rose. Can you tell us about breeds of sheep and your favorite breeds of sheep?
Well, I don't have a favorite breed, but I have what has worked for me. When I was milking the sheep, what I had were crossbred dairy ewes. So the really popular dairy breeds of sheep that are available in this country did not work in my system. They're relying on a lot of inputs and stuff, so which I didn't do. So we were developing our own land race, if you want to call it that, using some of those dairy genetics and some other genetics, with good mothering ability and everything. So I had what I called my mutts. And that's what I milked, and they were great.
What breeds are part of that?
So there were East Friesian, Dorset, Tunis, Leghorn, Texel, a little bit of all that in there. But now that I've retired from cheese making, I'm actually converting those dairy genetics by introducing a new kind of sheep. And that is, I'm converting my flock to become white Dorper. And that is a meat breed and a hair sheep. So I've always done my own shearing, and I don't want to do that anymore. So I'm breeding the wool out. So I have a couple more years of this transition, and then I will have purebred white Dorpers, hair sheep, and I won't need to shear. And they're so far, as I'm going through the transition, I have white Dorpers that are 50% and 75% white Dorpers, so not purebred yet. And I really like their temperament. I like their conformation. I like their carcasses. So I'm really pleased with that transition. It's going really well.
So I have a question because you were saying something about hair and you won't have to share them. So I don't understand because I really don't know
Is it
sheep.
straight rather than curly hair? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Or
Yeah, and it's not wool. It has a different look if you look under the microscope. It doesn't look like wool. It doesn't have the same properties as
Okay.
wool. And they shed. They'll
Oh,
shed those
okay.
coats. Yeah.
Okay.
So
Wow.
that's the big difference is a hair sheep. And there's several different breeds of hair
Yeah.
sheep. They shed, they don't have to be shorn.
Yeah.
One other thing I think is interesting that you might just touch on or make plain is there were multiple choices about how to make this transition. But by just buying one or two rams of this new breed, the White Dorper, it takes a little longer to convert one flock to a new flock. But at the same time, we're retaining some of the other qualities that have been bred in over the last 20 years that were important to us.
Yeah, I mean, I guess retaining some of those qualities, but mostly it's about management. I had a flock of sheep that knew this farm and knew this shepherd. And if I just said, okay, goodbye, I'm going to go bring in all these new sheep, I would have a circus on my hands.
Right.
I would have animals that are unfamiliar to the environment, unfamiliar to me. This way, I'm retaining that familiarity and that relationship and just changing it gradually over time. And the other important thing is my flock is certified organic, it's certified grass-fed. I couldn't buy that. That would be unavailable to me. So this way, I retain the integrity of those certifications and change the genetic makeup of the flock again over time.
Wow, that's
Wonderful.
great.
Now, how do you maintain their good health? What is their diet? You said they're grass-fed.
They eat fresh forage during the growing season and they eat dried stored forage during the winter.
Hey.
That's hay. That's why we make hay all summer.
Yeah.
That is for winter feeding. So they are supplemented only with minerals. They get free choice minerals, and we give them a choice of three. They get a high selenium Redmond salt, they get kelp, and they get a sheep NutriBalancer from Fertrel, and they get that free choice in little mineral feeders that I drag around the pasture with them so that they can choose what minerals they need.
It's important to Mary Rose and I that people understand when we say grass-fed, that's all they eat. Sometimes grass-fed is misunderstood to mean, well, until we fed them the grain. It doesn't mean that to us. Sheep and these animals that we have our horses to are perfect for eating grass. And that's what we've set out to do is make meat and make animals solely based on that. We don't use plastic to wrap our bales. We make only dry hay, and that's what we feed to our sheep and our horses. But you should talk a little bit more about other aspects of maintaining a healthy sheep when it is grass-fed and organic.
Yeah, I mean, sheep, small ruminants in general, have a reputation for being really susceptible to internal parasites. And there's one in particular that literally kills them. In an organic system, you have to manage for that without using parasiticides. And what we do is lots of things. There isn't one thing that we do. There's evasive grazing, and that is moving to clean pastures. We're fortunate here to have availability of all of this leased land so that we have a lot more land than we actually need. But it's because, well, number one, so we can make hay, but also so we can move these animals constantly to clean pastures, and they don't have to keep coming back to the same pasture that they've been on earlier in the season where they've deposited larvae from these internal parasites through their feces. So that's really important. There's just lots of things that we do to manage for internal parasites and to maintain the health of the animals. But again, I say that they are genetically programmed to work in this system. They evolved to eat forage. So that works in their favor. Yeah.
Now, do you get species other different grass? Do you get a broadleaf species, other things other than grasses?
Oh, yeah. So our pastures are all, what would we say, native pastures or unimproved. We don't plow and plant them. So we have lots of forbs and we have legumes and we have lots of grasses. And also now with the planting of these hedgerows, we get some browse for the animals too. So yeah, we try and diversify their diet in that way. Yeah.
Great.
They must be pretty happy sheep.
I think they're pretty
They're
happy.
happy. And sheep are pretty happy animals, and they're pretty happy sheep. Now,
Yeah, I know that when we would visit our friends when they had the sheep, they had what was the doll face sheep for a while. It was
oh,
just
the
the most,
South, baby doll South Downs or whatever. Yeah.
yeah, they were just, this was after the wildfires, they were the most calming creatures.
Yeah.
They didn't get fazed over anything, and you would walk in the pasture, and here we are, we were all PTSD.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm
And we
sure.
walked around those doll faces, and they
Yeah.
were just, you could
Yeah.
just breathe.
And not all sheep have that disposition. I really like these white Dorpers. They have a really calm temperament. It's really nice to work with them. Yeah.
Maybe we need sheep.
So it's said that when you grass feed animals, that the omega-3 ratio to omega-6 ratio is much better, much healthier in terms of our diet. Have you ever tested it?
No, I've never tested for it, but it is scientifically proven, yeah, that grass-fed meat and milk from grass-fed, 100% grass-fed animals, yes,
And you can
yes.
taste it, I'm sure.
You can't taste the omega-3 specifically, but yeah, no, but
You
yeah.
can taste the general healthiness of the
Absolutely.
meat. Yeah.
Absolutely.
We read that you provide affordable housing and land access to new farmers. I think that's something Elizabeth mentioned in the article. How do you do that, and what ideas for listeners wanting to do that in their places? Now, I know you mentioned you have a few houses and you have another farm family there.
Well, one of the things that's worked really well for us and may not work for everyone, because we've had for the last 10 years or more, we've had at least a couple, two or three different people here living here at a time. And my goal was to set up a relationship by which it was not too defined. None of the people that have lived here have worked for us as employees. Some have been interns that went on to stay. Many of them have had their own enterprises, although that was never a requirement. Some of them have had small scale enterprises where they might have dabbled. Some of them have really tried to build businesses. And we've encouraged all that, but none of it's been specific, like you have to do this in order to be here. Same thing with helping us. I didn't want a relationship that said, in exchange for this housing, you owe me 50 hours of haymaking, or you owe me 50 hours of something else. We charge a small rent, very small rent, and we trade. I help them plow their garden. They help us make hay. We don't track it. And that's on purpose, at least on my end. That's my ideal.
But the one thing that Don has required is that the people who are coming here have to be interested in the draft horses.
Yeah.
That's the commonality. It's not just anybody shows up here.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so we've been sharing that. And that's something that we have that we can make available. So we share that. And I like to teach that. And she's right. That is the common bond. So the system that we have is small rent and no too formal of an agreement. And I personally like that. It suits my style. It suits our style. Mm-hmm. And it's worked so far. We think maybe today we have some people that might be here for the long haul, and we're excited about that.
It seemed like we've had people would stay for about 3 years and then they move on to something else, which was fine. But yeah, I think
today we're settling into some folks that might be here longer, and that's great too. And so that would be my advice, is just opening up to it and finding what's good in it for everyone. And I'm a community oriented person. I'm like one of the most social people I know. I don't like to be by myself hardly at all. So that lends itself to this kind of situation.
It sounds a little like my husband. I always call him the party animal. You know, if we ever get out off the farm and go somewhere, we're always the last people to leave somewhere. He's having a blast. And I'm glad. And I'm glad he is.
Sometimes I'm all eager to get back.
Oh, never. So I have a question. How can listeners buy your products?
They can't.
I've always been notoriously bad about marketing, in that I dislike it intensely. And I sold the cheese and meat at farmers market for years, and I haven't done that now for many, many years. And even toward the end, I just went to all wholesale, so I didn't have to talk to people. All that's available now in the fall is some of our lamb that we will custom slaughter for people. So, I mean, if somebody's super interested, they should just email me and I'll see if I like selling something.
Right.
The main thing that we're selling today is meat, and that is all in the fall. Yeah, we do some custom, but we also have two or three other streams of sales. We do some wholesale. We do some halal. And so our meat is mostly spoken for. It's a very small number of lambs. And over the coming years, I'm going to sell one or two horses at a time, but mostly that's a matter of beating people off when I want to sell a horse.
And as I go through this transition of the flock, I do hope to be able to sell certified organic breeding stock also in the future. Because folks who want to add some livestock component to their already certified farm, this is a good way to do it, is to buy already certified stock.
I see you have milk ewes for sale. I don't know if they've been spoken for.
They've already sold.
Well, they're still here on the pasture. I want to move them late this summer and early fall. They've been spoken for multiple times, but they're still here. Ideally, I'd like them to go as a group to a working dairy, and that's still a possibility, although the woman who is supposed to take them is proving difficult to communicate with.
How many are there?
18. Yeah. Okay, so I have a number of people who want like two, and that's fine. Little homestead stuff, that's fine. That's probably how they'll go. I just find that's a harder transition for the animals, number one. And number two, it's a harder transition for me because I get lots and lots of follow-up questions.
But also what I hear in your voice is you would like them to leave as a family.
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, they have a flock mentality. Animals do know each other, and they know each other generationally. That's how sheep actually form their connections. It's not actually through their familial line. It's through their generational group.
And even while getting out of milking and cheese making, we'd still like to promote that as an opportunity for people. There's a business model out there for people to milk sheep and make cheese. And I think that's part of it too, is we'd love to see them go somewhere where they're successful in helping another business be successful.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We would love any of our listeners who are seriously interested to contact you.
ASAP.
Yeah.
We don't have the space here.
I know. But we should.
Our listeners do.
We should, you know, I could use some sheep hanging around.
I saw some great videos on the website in getting ready for the show. Really nicely filmed and edited about sheep and about draft animals, and wondering how you made them.
Yeah, we were really lucky that the Cornell Small Farms Program got funding. And that was like in 2006.
Long time ago. Those are old, by the way.
We looked a lot better then. To make these instructional videos, a number of farms in the region, and they hired this videographer, Peter Carroll, who is still a friend to this day. So wonderful to work with. And he was so talented and made these absolutely fabulous videos. We enjoyed the process. They even paid us. We all got paid a stipend to be involved. And, you know, I get responses from people around the world saying, oh, I'm in Macedonia and I saw your video. It was so great. And I wanted to ask you another question. Or some guy called me from Tripoli. I mean, really, people call from all over the world.
They've stood the test of time, too. I mean, there's a little bit, like, I know I said a couple of things, like, oh, I should have said that different. But those videos are really special. We were really lucky.
Yeah.
They've really stood the test of time really well.
Yeah. They're great.
That's been great.
When we had to do presentations in college classes, which we don't really like to do that much, but we could be talked into it, we would mostly just go and run the videos. And we'd sit when the videos are, anybody have any questions? That's how we do presentations in the college classes. There you go. That's all you need to know about us.
Well, that's the beauty of video. It can live forever.
Very, very well done. Yeah.
Yeah.
How are things changing for you with climate change?
Well,
it is changing. There's some changes that are obvious to us over the last 20 years. And there are some changes, which I think we are just starting to realize today, over the last 20 years. So we have gradually increased the square footage of concrete in our barnyards from what used to be like frozen, dry, rocky in the wintertime to like constantly muddy. And constantly muddy barnyards, when you bring your animals in, when you concentrate them in a small area because it's winter, and they have some indoor and some outdoor, and the outdoor would be hard and dry, it was fine. And that's the way these barns were built. They're built very low tech, very low expense, very simple, a covered shed for indoor, open area outside in a little paddock. That all turned to mud. And it would stay mud all winter because it would freeze and then thaw and freeze and then thaw. So we've gradually concreted that yard and another yard for horses because of mud is the worst.
Yeah.
That's one. Then another example would be, we've always made compost outside. Compost in a windrow in the summertime is fine. You turn that pile, it uses the heat of the day to energize the compost pile. In the wintertime, I used to haul horse manure from one of the barns that we clean in the winter, outside in the winter and make piles. I quit doing that. I built a shed specifically for wintertime cleaning. We have some sheep, most of our sheep are on a paddock that does not get cleaned all winter. It makes a bedded pack. But we have other horses that we clean all winter. And I clean that into a shed and put that underneath of a roof instead of putting it outside. Because it would be out in the rain all winter. It would be out in that 2-inch downpour, and raw manure in a 2-inch downpour is pollution.
Yeah, we used to have cold, snowy winters. We don't seem to have that.
When we moved here on this farm, which is a hill farm, we're at the top of a hill. We're at 1,400 feet. We could get buried in snow. This house that we built, you could walk off the roof into the snow drifts.
Wow.
For the first several years of life. Today, even in a snowy winter, it doesn't build up like that. The winds have changed. The snow has changed. Even in a snowy winter, it's not the same. in a non-snowy winter like last winter, there's no snow at all. So those are big changes. Knock on wood, the rain patterns are changing. They're challenging for haymaking, but we are still growing a lot of grass. We aren't experiencing devastating droughts.
Right.
And we just have to continue. Now, when I say in the future, it may continue to become more difficult to make dry hay, which is a unique and special thing. People that are doing all the bale wrapping don't realize, or if you're seeing all the bale wrapping, you don't realize that dry hay is its own special thing. And that's what we've always done. And that may become more challenging. The windows of opportunity to make the hay between the rainstorms. We'll see. Is that a climate change thing? Or is that just a couple bad years? Is that going to get worse? Don't know.
Yeah. But there's livestock health effects too.
Right.
You know, now that we don't seem to have that real winter kill in the pastures, it could be that we're going to have a buildup of internal parasite populations that are going to be challenging.
Yeah.
I mean, so far we're okay, but I could see that being a problem in the future. I saw an effect, I'm pretty sure this year, of something called Cache Valley virus, which is mosquito-borne, that affected the sheep. I had a couple of early abortions. Doesn't affect them other than that. They're fine. They're not infected for life or anything. But this is something we've never seen in this region, and now it's becoming more and more commonplace.
Wow.
That's crazy. You know, things are changing really rapidly, really rapidly. And I'm sure the vegetable growers can tell you many, many horror stories. Certainly one of our farmers here who's doing the medicinal herbs and culinary herbs, she's really struggled with the fact that we don't get winter kill now out here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the species are changing probably too. Your browse species and your grass species, is there some change in that too?
Yeah, we haven't really seen a huge effect of that yet.
There are changes going on in our fields. What I don't know is I can assert them to that.
Yeah.
We've always maintained what we call unimproved pastures for really valid reasons that are important to us. But what some people call weeds, we call different choices of eating. But there are some things like multiflora rows that are becoming problems. And I don't know if that's probably not a climate change related thing. Maybe it is.
I don't know. Yeah.
But there's some things that are growing in the pastures that we will have to think about.
Yeah, are getting worse. It's true. We've always had a little bit of multiflora rows here. And now it's becoming...
That could be a nutrient issue.
Really, really widespread.
It could be a nutrient issue. It could be some other issue that we don't know what it is.
Mm.
Yeah, I used to see it in Vermont at the same, a little higher than you in southern Vermont. I used to see a lot of multiflora rows way back. So it may be a nutrient thing. I don't know. And we have it here too, a little bit.
It's just now we're seeing, you know, we'll see it in the hay fields or in the pastures, just short ones. But
do they eat it?
Not have that.
No, that's the thing. Nothing eats it.
Maybe a goat
a little bit. So currently the only control that it's getting is mowing, which doesn't really kill it very well.
Yeah,
it just keeps it slowed down, but it doesn't really...
Yeah, so that at least we don't have these big thickets of it, but it's still...
Just
birds
strange how
it's a seed.
Yeah, it's strange how it's spreading.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are there any things we didn't ask you that we wish we had?
I think we covered a lot. No, I'm good.
Yeah, I think I'm good.
Let's do contact information again, how people can get in touch with you, Don and Mary Rose. Don Hughes and Mary Rose Livingston.
Yeah, we share one email address, so it works for both of us.
Yeah.
And that's TripleTree@frontiernet.net. And you can also look on our websites, teamsterschool.com and northlandsheepdairy.com.
Yep.
Those are the best ways to find us.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It was our pleasure.
And if you do happen to look us up and find our phone number, don't text us because it's a landline.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Gil.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We were just speaking with Don Hughes and Mary Rose Livingston of Northland Sheep Farm. Anyone interested in learning more about draft animal power or just hoping to meet some nice folks with horses, mules, and oxen should consider attending the annual Draft Animal Powered Field Days, held this year on September 27th, 28th, and 29th at the Orange County Farm Museum in Orange County, New York. An easy location to get to in the Hudson Valley. Website is draftanimalpower.org for details, schedules, or registration. Again, that's draftanimalpower.org.
Act for the future of 7 generations.
This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org, where you can also make a donation to support local programming on this great station. Thank you for listening.